Hello, it's Monday the 10th of May. I'm Andrew Pearce and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, and it's coming as ever from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, did you watch it? The Pursuit of Love, the adaptation of Nancy Mitford. I'll be talking to one of our star writers who gave it a so-so review. We'll be talking also about Boris Johnson, easing of more COVID restrictions. We can start hugging each other from next week. But guess what? The government are giving instructions on how to hug safely. Please. The Labour MP Tracy Brabin has become the West Yorkshire Mayor. Good news, you'd think, for Keir Starmer. Actually, not such good news. It means there's going to be a by-election in her constituency of Batley and Spen. And guess what? It voted heavily to leave the European Union. But first, Nicola Sturgeon has told Boris Johnson a second independence referendum is a matter of when, not if. I'm going to be talking to one of the leading members of the Scottish National Party in Westminster. So Nicola Sturgeon, the Scottish First Minister, re-elected with quite a decisive vote from the Scottish people. She's told Boris Johnson a second independence referendum is a matter of when, not if. There was a phone call between the two on Sunday afternoon. The First Minister pledged to work with the UK government on steering the country through the COVID pandemic towards recovery. I'm joined now by John Nicholson, who is a Scottish National Party MP, and he represents Ochil and South Perthshire. John, congratulations on the result. It was pretty stunning for the SNP.
It was an amazing result, wasn't it? It was the highest number of constituency seats ever won by a single party and most votes for any party ever, 1.3 million. So it was an extraordinary result, really, and not good for the Labour Party, the Tories or the Lib Dems. Lib Dems aren't a party anymore officially because they've got so few MSPs, and Labour's worst Scottish performance for 111 years. So I think we see where the direction of travel is taking us.
Yeah, and of course, there were such high hopes for the new Scottish Labour leader, Anas Sawa, and I'm afraid he didn't cut it, did he?
Well, he's got great personal charm, but I think his the whole kind of kumbaya act, I think can only take you so far. Let's stop fighting. Let's just love one another. I mean, politics is about debating ideas, and it's possible to have very strong friendships that cross the party lines. You and I have been friends for years and years and years. Yeah. We'll debate issues, but debate is absolutely what binds us together in a democracy, and it's immensely important. And Labour can't stand back from the central issue of Scottish democracy at the moment to try and sit on the fence, not least since Anas Sawa knows that 40% of his own voters support Scottish independence, and he's losing votes at every election. He lost another two seats this time round.
And Nicola Sturgeon says that COVID comes first, the referendum will come after that. Do you think realistically, John, it'll be a referendum at some point towards the end of next year?
I think we've got to wait until we're through the COVID epidemic. I think that's absolutely the right thing to do. I expect it's probably going to be tabled in the first 2 years of the Scottish Parliament. So I expect to see it in the next two years. But the crucial vote is going to come in at Holyrood, because it's not about the SNP or the Tories or Labour Party. It's about what Holyrood votes for, because how that vote goes determines whether or not we're going to have an independence referendum. And I expect, given the arithmetic, that Holyrood is going to vote for NDRF2.
Now, Gordon Brown, the former Labour Prime Minister, is out and about today signalling that he's going to fight the SNP as much as he can on independence.
No, really?
Yeah, funny that. And now, have you seen the figures? Paul Johnson from the Institute for Fiscal Studies has released figures today. He says, under the current circumstances with the Barnett formula, which devises how much money the Scottish people get from the government, he says overall spending per person is about 30% higher in Scotland than in England. Now, if you go for independence, John Nicholson, you're going to lose that huge dividend.
Andrew, I've been hearing this since the 1970s, when Scotland's oil was pumping down to fund the Thatcher experiment. We were being told by people like Gordon Brown that we were too rich, in effect, to be independent. And now they're telling us that we're too poor to be independent. I think the thing about Gordon Brown is that in the independence referendum in 2014, he spoke on behalf of the Westminster establishment, and he said that if we voted no to independence, the Scottish Parliament would become the most powerful non-independent parliament in the world. And he was promising things that he didn't have the power to deliver. So while I admire many things about Gordon Brown, I suspect he's something of a diminished figure when it comes to this debate, and people aren't really taking a lot of things that he says that seriously. In terms of the economy overall, I mean, nobody is promising that it's going to be a completely easy ride in every aspect. But we've got to be more ambitious than we are at the moment. And if you go through some areas of the East End of Glasgow, for example, you think this is one of the wealthiest countries in Europe. We have to do better than this. And I think to have the levers of the economy and to grow our own economy as an independent country is absolutely vital, because we should be performing Finland or like Denmark, comparable countries, and under Westminster we're not.
But what about that IFS figure, John Nicholson? Overall spending per person is about 30% higher than it is in England. How do you fill that big gap? Massive increases in taxes on the Scottish people?
Well, I'm a resident in Scotland, and I pay higher tax in Scotland. I do that on a voluntary basis because I believe in higher taxation in order to fund social services. So we have social provisions that sadly people south of the border don't have. We get free university education. Yeah. We've got free prescriptions. We've got free personal care. In retirement homes. I think these are all good things if they have to be funded through taxation. I'm relaxed about that because I'm much happier about the Scandinavian social model than the neoliberal American model, which would be supported by conservatives at Westminster. Independence will give us the levers to grow our economy and perform on the level that many of our small European neighbours perform. And those were the figures that were set out in the Growth Commission under Andrew Wilson, which gave us the blueprint going forward.
Just finally, John, on that, though, is there not the worry that because you may have to hike tax so much to pay for those services, so perhaps you have to scrap free university education or scrap free pensions, which would be hugely unpopular?
I don't think that's what we would do. I think we would have very different spending priorities. And I tell you where I would start immediately. I would start with Trident, the massively expensive nuclear weapons program that we have on the Clyde, which is unjustifiable. It's 20th century technology in a 21st century environment. And that would go immediately. What a huge saving that would bring to the Scottish taxpayer.
All right, that's John Nicholson, battling for independence. I'm sure we'll hear from him again. Why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show, or visit mailsubscriptions.co.uk to get access to every Daily Mail piece, plus exclusive podcasts, videos, opinion pieces, and more. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. So Boris Johnson is announcing today at the Downing Street press conference more easing of COVID restrictions from May the 17th. That's in England, at least. He says COVID won't beat us. Friends and relatives can, from next Monday, hug for the first time in a year, and we'll be able to go inside a pub rather than shivering outside one, as we do at present. I'm joined now by the Chief Executive of UK Hospitality, Kate Nicholls. Kate, is he announcing enough for you? Another week for pubs and restaurants?
Well, I think obviously we would want to be moving as quickly as we possibly could, but we understand the need for caution. I think our members are looking beyond the 17th of May. We're now wanting confirmation of the 21st of June and the lifting of all those social distancing restrictions. The data suggests that's possible, and that's what we want the government to focus on delivering, so that we can get businesses not just open, but back into viability and actually making a profit for the first time in 15 months.
So even though we're easing restrictions from next Monday in pubs and restaurants, for instance, there's still social distancing will have to be observed, which means that will constrict, presumably, the number of people your members can admit.
Yes, I mean, it's really helpful that we've got indoor hospitality open, as you rightly say. Outdoor only has been a washout the last couple of weeks, literally as well as metaphorically. But as we reopen indoors, we are reopening with the same restrictions. So occupancy limits, capacity constraints, requirements to be fully seated. You can't stand at the bar, you can't walk around and place an order. All of those mean that you've got supply restrictions, you've got demand suppressants, and it means that we can't break even. The costs of running the businesses with all of those social distancing restrictions over and above the 1 meter plus and the six people mean that our businesses don't break even. The costs are so significant in pressing down revenues. And so until we get those social distancing restrictions lifted, our businesses remain with a question mark over their future and their survival remains in doubt. So we do need the government to move quickly now to provide certainty for business confidence, consumer confidence, and then confidence for our workers, so that we can get moving again and know that the businesses have a secure future from the 21st of June.
How well have they done, the pubs and restaurants that have been able to open with those that have outside space? I know in central London it's been exceptionally difficult because a lot of restaurants and pubs in central London, and I'm sure that's the case in all our major cities, are very limited in their outside space. But have those that have opened, have they made any money, Kate, or have they been doing it to break even or probably even losing money?
I think it's a question of minimising the losses that you're sustaining and getting some cash through the doors. But nobody who's been reopened since the 12th of April has made a profit. Equally, for all of our businesses, when they reopened last July with the restrictions indoors and outdoors, only 1 week of the year last year did businesses break even, and that was the bank holiday weekend with the benefit of Eat Out to Help Out. So it's quite clear that this is a sub-economic opening. And we might be busy, those businesses that are open, busy and trading well, but still sub-economic and not profitable. So in the 12th of April, we opened a quarter of premises that had outside areas were able to open, and they were operating at about 20 to 30% of normal revenue level. So that's about 70% is what they need to break even. So this is about minimising losses, getting staff back, helping communities to have their services back, and it's about, you know, reopening hospitality and dusting down the cobwebs. We can't look towards economic reopening and that viability until we get to 21st of June and the restrictions being lifted. So that's why this is a welcome stepping stone on Monday the 17th, but it can only be a stepping stone. It's not a long-term solution.
And the impact, of course, on the sector you represent, Kate, the impact of lockdown has been dramatic, horrendous, frankly. How many businesses do you think have gone under and aren't going to come back?
Well, the impact's been catastrophic. We've seen 2/3 of our revenue wiped out over the course of COVID, and obviously all of that international travel business eliminated in its entirety. So it has been devastating. We've lost 12,000 businesses across the pandemic, particularly restaurants. We've seen 1 in 5 restaurants close, 1 in 10 hotels and accommodation providers, and 1 in 6 pubs. So it has been a significant contraction. We don't anticipate those premises coming back in the short term. They may re-emerge in the longer term, but our focus now has to be how many more could we still lose? How many more businesses could we hemorrhage over the course of the remainder of this year as we emerge from COVID? Because until we get those businesses back on a viable footing, able to earn money and generate profits, I fear we may lose as many again this year.
Have you been to the pub yet, Kate, or has it been too cold for you?
I've been to several, and I've also been to as many restaurants as I can fit in. I'm fortunate enough to live within walking distance of 5 brilliant pubs with outside spaces, so it would be very remiss of me not to have been, and I managed to see all 5 in the first opening day.
And did you have a drink in each one of them?
I did, but obviously our pubs will also do food, soft drinks and coffee. So it wasn't an alcoholic.
It wasn't a boozy pub crawl.
It wasn't, but it was with full ski gear on so that I could stay warm.
Very good. Good for you. That's Kate Nicholls, practicing what she preaches. She's the chief executive, of course, of UK Hospitality. If you enjoy The Andrew Pearce Show, why don't you subscribe to us? Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google or Spotify. And you can get in touch by tweeting us at MailPlus or me at ToryBoyPearce. So their Labour MP, Tracy Brabin, in a piece of good news, you'd think, for the Labour Party, she's been elected as the first West Yorkshire MP. But it may be not such good news for Keir Starmer, the embattled Keir Starmer, because it means another by-election. She is the MP for Batley and Spen, which voted 60% to leave in the 2016 referendum. So is this going to be another Hartlepool? I'm joined now by the Daily Mail's deputy political editor, John Stevens, who has his finger very much on the political pulse. John, this is a by-election they need like a hole in the head, frankly.
After the disaster of last week in Hartlepool, Keir Starmer must have been hoping that he wasn't going to hear the words by-election for quite a while. But here we are just a few days later, and it looks like we're going to have a by-election in the next couple of months, probably the end of July.
Now, it's in Labour's gift when they call it, because it's a Labour MP standing down. They will be trying to get it presumably as far away from the lifting of lockdown and the vaccine rollout programme.
Yeah, I mean, it is in Labour's gift. They can decide when the by-election is, but they can't, you know, drag it out too long. And so I think we will see it before the summer holidays. And by then, I'm not sure we'll be in a totally different situation. But it may be quite good for Keir Starmer to get this out of the way. If it is bad, you know, get it done, move on. I don't think he wants it right before party conference season, which is when he must kind of perform and kind of take things up a gear and show that he has got some potential to be the next Prime Minister.
And his reshuffle, you and I know reshuffles, it doesn't make a lot of difference when you're in opposition, because he's moving people around who most people have never heard of and replacing them by people that most people have never heard of. But the car crash over the deputy leader, Angela Rayner, suggests that this is a Labour leader who's struggling to assert his own authority, because he had to spend most of the day haggling and negotiating with a woman he tried to demote.
Yeah, I mean, he looks terribly weak that he's had to back down and that there's all this wrangling's been going on, and that Angela Rayner's allies are felt able to brief the press in quite the way they did. But I just don't quite understand why he ever thought he'd be able to get away with it. You know, leaders can do a big reshuffle where they kick out all of their enemies and, you know, assert themselves after they've had a big victory. But that is clearly not what Keir Starmer had last week in elections. They were really miserable for him. That how his team ever thought they'd be able to carry this off, I just don't know. It just seems ridiculous. You do big change like this when you're at the height of your powers, not when you're at a complete low point.
Yeah, it was extraordinary. We'd heard him being very magnanimous and saying, I take full responsibility for the defeat. And then within 24 hours, it's been briefed that he's fired a Northern woman Labour MP, a single mother. She ticks a lot of boxes for Keir Starmer. And you think, how is that accepting full responsibility for what went wrong?
Yeah, I think most members of the public will think that as well. And, you know, Labour, it's not that hard to trigger a civil war. You know, there's so many factions that hate each other so much. You think you've been a bit more careful to avoid setting it all off again?
Just finally, John, I read a very interesting article by Tom Harris, the former Scottish Labour MP. He suggested, is Keir Starmer a politician? Is he any good as a politician? He was a clever lawyer. He was the director of public prosecutions. He's only been an MP since, 2015? Is he very political? Does he have very good political judgment? Because it has to be said, the campaign was useless. I thought he was flat-footed. He appeared flat-footed and bovine, and his handling of the reshuffle has been woeful.
Yeah, when Keir Starmer took over from Jeremy Corbyn, one of the key things that he promised was that his leadership of the Labour Party would be much more competent. You wouldn't have seen all the shambolic things that happened under Jeremy Corbyn. But actually, as time goes on, a lot of Labour MPs who are supportive of Keir Starmer are starting to question, actually, does he kind of have the nous to be able to get a victory? And it doesn't seem like he does.
Why doesn't he do something about his voice? Every time I hear him on the radio, I think there's a robot or Dalek speaking. It's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, Mrs. Thatcher had voice training, and they tried to do something about William Hague's awful accent, but didn't succeed. And I think they should do something about it, but they're probably not going to take any advice from me.
Well, no, but also, if you're the opposition leader, it's difficult to cut through. You know, yeah. The Prime Minister is able to do stuff that impacts people's lives immediately. If the opposition leader is speaking, it's obviously hard for people to take notice. But because it's harder, you need to make more of an effort to get your messages through. And you listen to a Keir Starmer speech, and, you know, after 15, 20 minutes or whatever, you think to yourself, what has he said? And you've got no clue, because you've just switched off and gone to sleep.
I know. He was on the radio. He was on the Today programme last week, and we chatted about it here. He listed five things he'd done since he was Labour leader, or five things he was going to do. None of us could remember a single thing of the five things he'd raised. Isn't that extraordinary?
Yeah.
There we are. That's John Stevens. He's the deputy political editor of the Daily Mail, and we'll be bringing you, of course, all the latest on the botched reshuffle in the paper and on Mail Plus in the days ahead. So here we go. It's that time of the podcast. Deputy sports editor Matt Gatwood's here with the latest. Well, that was supposed to be a big moment for Man City, and they blew it.
They certainly did, and they blew it in spectacular fashion at the weekend.
Did they?
Yeah, well, so they obviously had Chelsea to play where they needed to win, and they would win the league and put it to bed.
They were ahead.
They went ahead. They went ahead early on, and then they had a chance to go 2-0 up just before half time, when Sergio Aguero, obviously their top scorer of all time and a hero who won the league for them back when he scored that famous goal to beat QPR, stood up to take a penalty.
Oh.
And he tried to be a bit clever. He tried to do a thing called a Panenka. Now, do you know what a Panenka penalty is?
I barely know what a penalty is.
So a Panenka is a penalty where you run up towards the ball and you hope that the goalkeeper will dive either left or right, and then you very gently chip it down the middle, making the goalkeeper, who's now dived, look stupid as the ball floats gently into the net. So, you know, a lot of people have done them and they have been successful in the past. If it goes wrong and the goalkeeper doesn't dive and it floats very gently into his hands, you can look somewhat of a fool.
So he looks somewhat of a fool?
He looks somewhat of a fool.
Are they still going to build a statue to this man?
I think they might, because he is, as I say,
maybe Man United can, maybe they're going to choke.
Well, I don't think they'll choke, but there is no doubt Pep Guardiola was not best pleased with Aguero afterwards, and Aguero then tweeted an apology to everyone after the game, which does seem a bit harsh, because if it had gone in and the goalkeeper had, everyone would say, oh, look at that, what genius. But it didn't. Fine lines. And
how much does this bloke get paid a week?
He gets paid a few bob. So he'll be on your 250 grand a week, I imagine. So, you think he should be able to score a pen?
I could probably score from a penalty spot.
I doubt that, but yeah, you could certainly give it a go.
That's pretty harsh. Pretty harsh.
But yeah, so that meant that obviously then the ball was back in Manchester United's court. Yeah. They went and won yesterday.
They beat Aston Villa,
So they beat Aston Villa. They then now play again on Tuesday, tomorrow, against Leicester. They need to not lose that to prolong this agony or title race, depending on how you look at it. Then they play again on Thursday against Liverpool. Again, they can't afford to lose that. And if they win both of them, or at least win and get a draw in those two fixtures, Man City can then win the league on Friday night when they play Newcastle.
Well, they're going to beat, they're hopeless, Newcastle.
Newcastle are fairly hopeless, except they went and beat Leicester 4-2 on Friday night.
Oh,
so,
did they?
So, but you would expect City, you know, to actually go and win it. I still don't think. If Man U win those two games, they'd be 4 points behind as City get to that.
Yes.
So the pressure would be slightly on, but I still think...
Sam Allardyce is going down for the first time in his career because he manages West Brom.
Perfect.
Look at that.
So he manages West Brom. It's the first time he's ever gone down, been relegated from the Premier League.
Right.
So he's managed 534 games. This is just off the top of my head, I think.
Yeah.
He's managed eight different Premier League clubs and he's been managing in the Premier League on and off for 20 years.
Right.
And obviously, he's managed a lot of clubs towards the bottom half of the league. He's never been the Man U or the Man City or the Liverpool manager, and had never been relegated until yesterday when he, of course, came up against the might of Arsenal, who beat West Brom.
Your team.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad they can win some games.
He can only beat teams who are going down.
Yeah.
So they won 3-1.
So will they sack Allardyce?
They're going to have talks about whether he stays on. Now, he is, you know, basically, if they give him enough money, not for him, but if they give enough money for him to be able to invest in the squad that he thinks he'll be able to get them back up, then I think he'll stay. If they say, sorry, you know, there's no funds, then he may well walk away.
Isn't this a bloke who had to stand down after managing England after one match because of something, shall I put it in inverted commas, something dodgy?
Yes, this is the man. And he obviously, you know, still maintains that he did nothing wrong there.
Why did they skittle him out of England?
They skittled him out because it wasn't a great look when he was offering his services for appearance fees for quite large sums of money when he was already England manager. So, it was a pretty ugly look. But
absolutely. Now, I know what this means. Rory McIlroy has won a tournament.
Yeah. So
he's won quite a few in his time.
He has.
He's had a lean spell.
He's won a lot in his time, and actually, for someone of his age, he's actually won, you know, far more than the majority of golfers will ever win. And certainly, some who've been playing their whole careers wouldn't be anywhere near the amount that he's won. But he's been a long wait. So
right. Where did he win?
He won in North Carolina at the Wells Fargo Championship.
Right,
which. You know, it's not a major or anything like that, but we are only a week away from the next major, the USPGA. So it's perfect timing for Rory to win. It's the first time he's won for 18 months. And not just, you know, hasn't really contended. He hasn't really been on the radar of winning in lots of tournaments. So for him, it's a great boost. It's great. It's timely. He does love this course. He's won at this course before.
Right.
But it's just a great boost for him going into a major. So maybe he could end this wait for a major, which is going on and on.
And he does seem like a very nice bloke.
He's a lovely bloke.
Yeah.
And he's actually a very intelligent and thoughtful bloke. And
right.
He actually was one of the few who came out last week to say how disgusted he was by the attempts by the Saudi Arabians to form a new golf league, who were just throwing money at players and offering them away. And he just said, you know, this is not for me. You know, it's not all about money and blah, blah, blah. So he was, you know, good in coming out and speaking out against these things. So, good lad. We like him.
We like him. We like him. And we like Matt Gatwood, which is why we get him in here as often as we can. Deputy Sports Editor, thanks for joining us. Lily James has already made the headlines for The Pursuit of Love after an alleged affair with Dominic West, who plays her dad. No wonder, says Jan Moore, who reviews the three-part Nancy Mitford adaptation, The Pursuit of Love, in the Daily Mail today. And she joins me now. What was it like, the chemistry between the two of them, Jan?
Well, I mean, this, of course, is the big BBC production for Sunday nights. And it was on the set of The Pursuit of Love, that Dominic West and Lily James were alleged to have had a close friendship. Mm. But, of course, none of that, whether that's true or not, none of it leaks into the scenes here, because, of course, they play father and daughter.
Yes.
He is Lord Auchinleigh, also known as Uncle Matthew, and she is his wayward daughter, Linda. So in the first episode, they had a few scenes together, but, you know, I'm afraid nothing that would titivate gossip watchers.
No. Now, what of the drama? It's based on the Nancy Mitford book, of course. Is it dated? Is it aged well?
Well, The Pursuit of Love is a much-loved novel by me and millions of others. It's Nancy Mitford's sort of classic interwar novel about a sort of a family who live in a great house and their daughters. I mean, it's loosely based on her own life. She was one of the Mitford sisters, that's what it's based on. No, I don't think it has dated, but the treatment of it in this particular adaptation, well, I don't know. I tell you, it hasn't gone down well with Daily Mail readers. If you look online, they are furious about it. One reader said, "Watching deranged toffs agonising over love, no thanks." What is interesting about this is being directed by the actress Emily Mortimer, who also wrote the adaptation. Now, this is her first ever time as a director, and I'm afraid to say that it shows. You know, she's gone into the bag of tricks. We've got slow-mo, we've got slogans on the scene, we've got voiceovers. And she's also given it a sort of a modern soundtrack with music from, you know, people like Mark Bolan and New Order. And it's all a bit of a big boiling mishmash. And to be honest with you, it hasn't really worked.
And how many weeks does it run, Jan?
It's a three-parter,
right.
So we've only got two more weeks of this to plough through.
Do you think people will tune in for the second week?
I think a lot of people might not. A lot of people might have thought, well, one episode was enough. But I'm going to be tuning in, even though I had my reservations about it, even though I only gave it 3 stars in my review today. I mean, it has got things going for it. It looks absolutely gorgeous. They spent a fortune on costumes and backgrounds and things. Everyone in it looks wonderful. There's a wonderful cameo from Andrew Scott.
Yeah, who's great. I love him.
Who plays Lord Merlin as if he's sort of David Bowie or something. I mean, he's just absolutely hilarious. He has all the best scenes in it. And I feel that he does Nancy Mitford justice. But when it comes to Dominic West, who's an actor who I really like, I mean, he's brilliant in everything. But here is Uncle Matthew, who's meant to be an affectionate eccentric, but he plays him as if he's a raging psychopath. I mean, I don't know what's got into him. And I'm not sure about that walrus moustache either.
No, I was about to say, why did they put that moustache on him? So Lily James has had a checkered acting career. Some people don't think she's particularly strong. She was, of course, in Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again. I sat next to her at a production of Mamma Mia on the London stage. She's very nice,
Andrew,
and very affable.
Do anything to get Mamma Mia. Well, yeah, of course, you know me. You know me.
But does she come of age in this as an actor?
Well, I think it's interesting about her. I mean, she's like the Dame Judi Dench of the sort of bright young things.
Yeah.
She gets all the roles.
She does.
She's in Mamma Mia. She was in Rebecca to no great effect, I thought. I thought that role was sort of a bit beyond her. But for the first time, I sort of really get her. I think she's wonderful in this. I mean, she plays this sort of effervescent, beautiful young woman who's obsessed with love and a little bit silly. And she sort of captures Linda's wonderful spirit. So I quite like her in this. I think she's done really well. I'm a total opposition with the critic from the Daily Telegraph, who said exactly the opposite, that she quite liked it, but she couldn't stand Lily James's
Isn't it fascinating?
Role.
It's how people see things. Well, that's The Pursuit of Love. So, Jan, I haven't watched it. So should I watch it on Catch
Well,
Up?
Yes. I mean, watch it for Andrew Scott alone. He's hilarious.
He is great. And I saw him on stage in the days when we could go to the theatre, Jan,
well,
which are coming
that?
Back soon. That is the wonderful Jan Moyer talking about The Pursuit of Love. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.